Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, to find common ground and take it to the next level with David Clark here on Blog Talk Radio. Each week, the show will encourage you to keep an open mind and prepare to open the door to new understandings. We will have an exciting array of diverse guests who will point up the fact that we are all spiritual beings having a human experience. Now your host, David Clark.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, where we will be finding common ground and taking it to the max level. I'm your host, David Clark. I'm a spiritual adventurer, and I suggest you become the same. When you keep an open mind, you'll come to see that despite our seeming differences, we're all basically the same. You'll also see where you can find common ground so that you can relate rather than compare yourself to others. Now tonight, my special guest is Dr. John House. He creates his novels from his vast and varied experiences in life. He's actively involved in family medicine and previously spent time in sports, prison, and urgent care medicine. He has traveled extensively, including mission trips to Belize, and has sailed and scuba dived in the Virgin Islands, Bahamas, and Belize. To relieve the stress of a busy medical practice, he spent weekends hiking in the Appalachian Mountains with Tall Guy, a companion well-versed in nature. Prior to becoming a novelist, John published poetry, and he also won prizes for short fiction. His first two novels, So Shall You Reap and Choices, were written with locations based in northern and coastal Georgia. His third novel, Trail of Deceit, is based on his knowledge and love of nature. A native Georgian, John received his BS from North Georgia College, his MD from Medical College of Georgia, and completed further training at Memorial Medical Center in Savannah, Georgia. He served 4 years in the U.S. Army, including a tour in Vietnam with the 1st Cavalry Division. John and his wife, Pam, live on the southeast coast of Georgia, and all his creative works involve the richness of the southern culture. And so I'd like to introduce John. John, once again, how are you tonight?
I'm doing fine, David. Thank you very much for including me in your show.
You're welcome. Thank you for joining me. I love the titles of your books. And as we were talking before the show, you mentioned they all have to do with the light and dark sides of human nature. And I'd like to start out the show just talking a little bit about how you segued into writing. And did it start out with the poetry and the short fiction before you wrote novels?
That's correct. I started writing poetry as early as high school, continued on into college when I had spare time. I used to love to go up in the mountains and find a nice spot to just sit and think and write. And in medical school, I didn't have as much time to devote to writing. But after I finished school and got out of the Army and started my practice, I started doing some writing on the side just as entertainment. But once I thought I was going to retire in 2007, which my retirement only lasted 3 weeks, I missed medicine so much that I told my wife I had made a horrible mistake, and I immediately started seeking employment, and I've been steadily employed now for the past 8 years, back into medicine again. And
good
during
for
that
you.
Time, I started writing. I went to a conference and started pursuing. It's really another education to become a novelist. A tremendous amount of material to read and digest in regards to description and characters and plot and point of view, things that before I just kind of didn't pay much attention to, but if you want to get something published, you have to, and it's been extremely enjoyable.
Well, when did you first, when did you write your first novel, and how long did it take you?
The first one took about 2 years, and that was one called Social Urete. And that was not devoting every day to writing. I was so busy with practice of medicine that I just did it on weekends. The story came to me because of the government's interference in medicine, and I had so many of my friends that were retiring early because they didn't like the way medicine was turning, and I got thinking about it, and so I started the story about a physician, well known in his community, very successful practice, but because of his disenchantment, he got involved in selling drugs. And he started off small, kept building up, finally became connected with the Columbia cartel, and he lived in a university town and, of course, had a ready market. His son was the star quarterback for the college in this town, and he had no idea his father was involved in this, and he got more involved after his younger brother died from tainted drugs. And with friends, he began to investigate what was going on, not knowing that the person that he was seeking would turn out to be his father.
Oh, wow.
And the story has a lot of twists and goes through that in some his love life with PJ, his college mate and love, and two friends named Carlos and Eddie that were friends of his younger brother that helped him. And I won't give out any more than that about what happens at the ending.
Well, it sounds like a very intriguing novel. You know, we'll get into talking about how people can head down trails that betray themselves later in the show. As I mentioned, I love the titles of your novels, and especially Choices, because we all have to make choices each step of the way in this life, and they can have profound effects on our future, both for ourselves and for those that surround us. What is Choices about?
Choices, again, involves medicine. It's about a young ER physician who just finished his tour in the ER on Christmas Eve, and he is a single guy, and he decides to stop by a convenience store to pick up some milk and corn pops for a very un-Christmas-like dinner. And while there, he gets caught up in a robbery that goes bad and turns into a hostage situation. The main part of the story, as in the first story, Social Urete, the physician was basically a sociopath. And he had his dark sides. But in Choices, the villain, Jaco, is an absolute psychopath. In and out of prison, has no concept of right and wrong, has no empathy for anyone except himself. And this young physician not only has to take care of people who are wounded in a shootout that takes place in the convenience store, but he also has to try to figure out a way to save the hostages. And he does so by volunteering to be a hostage when the police negotiate them to leave. They think that they will be able to separate them before they actually get away, but they don't, because they have done something to make sure that the police can't interfere. And the chase takes them to the Okefenokee Swamp, which is a huge swamp in southeast of Georgia. And the story goes from there about how they pursue them. And the entire time, Dr. Bajorski, who is that ER physician, is trying his best to convince Jaco, the villain, that he should stop and think about what he's doing. And he's not only going to ruin his life, but ruin the lives of his two companions. But he just, as the story will, for those who read it, you'll find out it just doesn't work out that way.
Sounds very creative. How did you ever come up with these scenarios?
I have no idea. some of my patients told me they were a little bit worried. thought in my head. Choices didn't take as long as the first book, because it just, after I'd written that first book, it seemed like the words just came to me. And some nights I would write for 2 or 3 hours at a time, and especially on weekends. And then after I finished that book, I spent several years on my last book called Trail of Deceit, the one about the Appalachian Trail. It's by far my best book, and I think a little bit more professional than the first two.
Again, what is Trail of Deceit about?
It's about four college students who take time during the fall break to hike on the Appalachian Trail, a section of it, and they become victims of a stalker. This guy is a sociopath, pretty close to a psychopath as well. His situation, rather than being a genetic situation as psychopaths are often labeled, is more from nurture. He started off with a fairly good life until he lost his father and mother. His father was killed in Vietnam. He was taken in by his grandparents. Things happened to them as well. And finally, he was on his own as a young kid. He decides just to stay in the mountains, and he lives alone. He's victimized by older people, older boys, and which changes him considerably. And he just becomes basically a wild man in the mountains of the Appalachians, and rarely goes into town. He's learned to exist on his own. And then I won't give away the story on how he gets involved with these particular four people, but it just goes downhill. And then one of the young girls breaks her leg, and she's left by the others as they go to seek help. He kidnaps her and takes her for his own and takes her to a cave and where he has lived. And then the story goes from there as her attempt to show love to this guy, even though, you know, he is not a very good person. And I won't give away the rest of it from there, but it ends up a good story.
Well, I'm just curious, how can we show love to people like that that would victimize us? I'm not asking you to give away the story, but I'm just wondering, in the scheme of human relations, when we encounter people that would seek to perpetrate acts against us, how does love fit into the equation?
Well, for psychopaths, there's not much chance. But we all have a dark side. And this can come out in simple things like just lies and manipulation, jealousy, aggression, you know, minor aggression, or it can even turn out to be significant violence, such as things like road rage. The media has learned to play on this, too. You see movies where soldiers in the middle of a bloody battle then all of a sudden risk their lives to save a puppy, something totally opposite of what they're doing. I remember in a episode of MASH when Margaret Houlihan, the chief nurse, always plays the tough head nurse, and she tries to hide that fact. And in one episode, you know, she is secretly feeding a stray dog without anybody knowing it, and then she just breaks down totally when this dog is hit by a jeep and killed. And it shows that we have a dark side there to us. Sometimes it comes out in anger, sometimes just trying to deceive people. But when people don't try to, you know, have some type of use of their dark side, you know, they become like a spineless person, you know, incapable of defending themselves. And so we use our dark side for, you know, for protection of ourselves or our family. It's qualities that we probably want to deny that we have, but they're there. And we use them in various situations. Those people who try to repress them end up projecting what they don't think of themselves. They end up projecting that on other people. And
Yeah, that's where judgment comes in. And so often it seems to me that people that judge are not in touch with their own shadow self and are seeking to cast judgments against others because they can't take a look at or embrace their full humanness, if you will. And without being able to do that, people are not really whole and complete and not in touch with themselves, and it seems that it makes it hard for them to remain true or to make choices to leave those dark elements behind, leave the ego aside, except for preservation purposes, for protection of family and loved ones, and to make choices to walk in the light. And what do you think about that?
Well, I think it's absolutely true. It just we're trained from childhood, you know, to our parents tell us to always make a good impression on other people, and but sometimes we're totally different when we're on our own, and anything that is not considered socially acceptable is our dark side, and that leads to, when people try to suppress that and never let it show, that's what ends up leading to depression, anxiety. People have a significant amount of jealousy and develops into hatred, which is another human emotion that comes naturally to us, but you know, if utilized in the wrong way, it can become disastrous. Murders occur in homes that would be normally loving, but something triggers somebody, and in just a split second, things can happen that change the lives of the entire family forever.
That's true. It's amazing. how life can turn on a dime sometimes. And that's why I maintain it's so important to remain aware. I'd like to talk some more about that, but before we do, is there a way for people to get in touch with you? Do you have a website?
Yes, I do. It's www.johnhouseauthor.com.
And where is the best place for people to get a hold of your books?
It's on both print and electronic through Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com, and almost any bookstore can order it. Some of them already have it on the shelves, but unfortunately not very many. And most of my friends and all usually, it seems like everybody's got a Kindle these days, so that's the way they go, because you can carry around so many books in that one little electronic device. Personally, I'm still one of those people that I like to hold probably in my hand. And,
same here.
And I read.
Yeah.
It just it seems like I can just get more involved with it if it's something I've got right there in my hand. So.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you talked about the light side. That is something we can all, you know, relate to. We saw bullies when we were in high school, and how easy it is sometimes to change a bully to a friend just by showing compassion to that person and make them your friend. And all of a sudden, they totally. And the sociopath, or the person who, say, below average in school and other people isolate him, he can become a complete sociopath and want to inflict harm on others. Where if somebody just shows just a little bit of love toward him, a little bit of understanding, often can change a lot of people. One reason prisons don't work. I'm not against prisons. People have to go to prison. But, you know, quite often if somebody had just taken an interest in people, especially young kids, before they get to that point, because once they go into prison, they learn how to be a professional criminal. And,
right.
Some don't, but majority of them do.
Well, I liked what you were saying about showing some compassion and understanding towards somebody that is behaving badly, if you will. I've often heard it said that when somebody is angry with you, that's actually a cry for help, be it understanding or seeking love and just not knowing how to express that. What do you think about that?
I think you're absolutely right. I have a personal situation. When I was in what's considered middle school now, I had this guy that liked to whack on me every day. He was much bigger, and I had a bit of a temper too, and so it didn't take much for him to start picking on me, for me to start, you know, wanting to fight back. I usually lost, and later on I'd think, what in the world did I do that for? You know, I knew I was not going to win. But then I changed tactics. I just asked him one day, you know, what is it about me you don't like, you know? And so we just got to talking, and later on he became one of my best friends. And he was just basically one of those individuals that people, for some reason, just didn't like him, maybe his looks, maybe because he always acted like a bully. But he was basically just reaching out for somebody to offer friendship.
Hmm. Well, especially in children, I guess what I was leading up to is that we all are children inside, and when you're dealing with a child and seeing those kinds of behaviors, it's a little bit easier to show compassion and recognize that the child is hurting at some level. When they're adults, we expect them to behave like adults, to behave responsibly, to be to practice love and understanding and qualities that we would consider to be socially acceptable. And when people aren't doing that, I think that we're forgetting that they're really just hurting children that are not in touch with what it is that they actually need at those points in time. And so I love what you were saying about compassion. I have a woman who's a regular guest on my show. She's a healer by the name of Ada Marie. She lives out in Arizona, and she also has her own radio show. And she says, ultimately, love is always the answer. And it makes me think about the situation over in Paris and how people are reacting to the violence that the extremists have perpetrated upon innocent people. What are your thoughts about dealing with situations like that?
Well, the only thing I can say is thank goodness, you know, I'm not one of our leaders. It's going to be a hard situation to deal with. Right now, it'd be very hard for anyone to show love to any of those people.
Right.
When I was doing some reading, just preparing for the show, I came across a quote by Gandhi. It said, "When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There has been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they seem invincible. But in the end, they always fall. And think of it, always fall." Gandhi. You know, the it'll be the same way with these terrorists. It's going to take military action, but somewhere along the line, it's going to take someone with the capability of reaching out to these youth that are signing up to blow themselves up and convince them that that is not what Allah or God or anyone else, you know, wants them to do. And maybe when they're reached and they wipe out that base of youth, the rest of it will die on the vine. I think it's what God means. If we reach out with the truth and love, sooner or later, these people who think they're going to control the world won't.
I hope you're right.
But, yeah. You know, a lot of times, too, we have to understand that in order to help somebody else, we have to understand ourselves, too. And if we don't love ourselves for whatever reason, someone we've hurt or someone has hurt us, we let darkness begin to enter our lives, and we close off our hearts to other people. And you can't help someone, you know, if you don't even like yourself. And,
It said that God helps those who help themselves, and you know, as you say, it all starts with self-love and being compassionate toward yourself before you can practice that with other people.
That's true. And sometimes the hardest person to love is yourself. If you let the darkness get in your soul and you won't forgive yourself, it's hard to forgive anybody else, and it's hard to forgive what they do. And we heal darkness only with, you know, love and the light of love.
And we can beat ourselves up over the silliest little things, like being late for work, not recognizing that we are human beings subject to error, and focus on bad me. You know, once again, that's a very self-abusive thing to do. And then we hold these. At the same time, we don't allow other people to be human. We expect them to be perfect, and start casting judgments against them.
Well, those who had role models, like I have with my parents, that show, you know, nothing but love. Yeah, they make mistakes, but primarily they show love all the time, and you know, and you can rely on it, and you know, no matter what you do, they're going to love you. If everyone had that type of background, then there wouldn't be this kind of problem that they have.
Right.
But unfortunately, right now in the Middle East, they're being taught a whole, they're being taught something they say comes from the Quran, but it really doesn't. It's somebody else's interpretation of what's in the Quran. And they're taking that and twisting it and making darkness out of it instead of the light that should come from the, of loving your fellow man.
Well, that's a form of manipulation or lying, the deceit that you were talking about earlier. And that's it's really hard when you're dealing with somebody that's bought into total darkness. You know, I think about some of the darkest chapters in human history and people like Adolf Hitler, who totally, seemingly, turned from the light and chose to pursue evil things. And it makes you wonder what happened to them to turn them into such twisted individuals.
Well, in Hitler's case, from the things I've read, it could have been something as minor, you know, as rejection of his art. He considered himself quite an artist, and he presented some work. Some people in it basically just laughed at, and that set him on a course that spiraled down from there, and he just kept putting himself deeper and deeper into darkness. Until he basically began to hate everyone.
Well, you've lived a life based on service, and I'm more than a little bit interested in your own spiritual journey, how you happened to come into practicing medicine and your mission trips to Belize. Would you be willing to share something about your journey?
Yes, it would. I primarily got interested in medicine because of my family doctor. That's back in the days when they made house calls, and my father had heart problems, and so I saw a physician at home quite often, and I just liked the way he dealt with people and the good he tried to do for people, and he was always available, and I'm sure as I found out later on, it pretty much takes a lot out of your own family life. I had five children, and I didn't get to spend a whole lot of time with them during the early years of my practice when they were real young, because I was either at the hospital, at the emergency room, or seeing patients in the hospital. That was back before the days of full-time emergency room physicians, so in a small town, the general practitioners, family practitioners were pretty much it. You know, we took turns on rotating in the emergency room, and when you got called, you had to go, and it pulled you away from quite a number of dance recitals and other fun things that children were doing. I think most of my evening meals came from the refrigerator into the microwave, you know, because everybody else had already eaten and long gone to bed before I got home. But I would not change it for anything because I love medicine. Some dentists at the Methodist Church where I was attending at that time got me interested in going to Belize. They were building a parsonage there for the minister, and different churches rotated. And in addition to taking the people down who did the carpentry work, we also took physicians and dentists to do what we could while we were there. I met a missionary couple while I was there, and found out she was pregnant, and she was terrified because she had only been there for a short period of time. She couldn't imagine delivering her baby in such a backward area. I opened my big mouth and said that I would love to come back down with the equipment and deliver her baby. Before I said that, I had to do it. The hospital was gracious and gave me two complete sets of equipment I would need for the delivery. And that worked out well because when I delivered her baby, there was a Peace Corps worker in the same area who was almost time for delivery as well, and they asked if I would deliver their baby. And since I had the equipment, I did so. So I delivered two babies that one trip. And then I went back down 2 years later and delivered the missionary's couple next child. And that was quite an experience for me. I wrote an article for the Medical Economics magazine. Unfortunately, it wasn't accepted, but I thought it was pretty good. I don't think too many people have had that kind of experience, but for my own personal satisfaction, it was quite an emotional and uplifting thing to be able to help out like that. I grew up in a family that went to church regularly, and I, like I said, had parents that they showed me the light and the love continuously. Can't say that I've always done that to my children, but as I get older, I try to do a better job.
Well, that's all any of us can do. And also, I think to recognize that no matter what's come to pass, that we did the best that we could each step of the way with what we knew about ourselves at the time. And so therefore, I think we need to show compassion to ourselves. And I believe everything happens for a reason, whether we judge it as good or bad. Ultimately, it can all serve a good purpose if we perceive it in that light. What do you think?
I think so, because I know that my children recognize that I didn't do everything right. Made a lot of mistakes and was not there at the time I should have been. But now that they're all adults, I think they've forgiven me, you know, my mistakes. And they have developed into wonderful adults and are raising children of their own and in the churches. And they're very loving to them. They attend all their school activities. I have my two oldest grandchildren are in college. I have another one will be there next year. Their upbringing by their parents has been nothing but love. And all the others are their children are younger, but they're following the same footsteps. They're wonderful parents. And I don't think anybody can have anything happier to happen to them than to see their children grow up with their grandkids and or their children and make them loving individuals.
That's beautiful. When you were talking about your children forgiving you, I was just thinking about the concept of forgiveness in general. Earlier in the program, we were talking about some toxic emotions like hatred and jealousy, which can lead to things like resentments, which are very poisonous, and the only person that they hurt are ourselves. And so it seems that the only logical way to release them is to practice forgiveness. What do you think about that?
That's absolutely true. I've counseled many couples over the years. And it seems like no matter what goes on in the home, no matter how it started out, how loving it started out, jealousy is one thing that can totally destroy it. And it doesn't have to be jealousy over another person. It can be jealousy over the spouse's job or jealousy over the spouse's hobby. If they feel like they're taking time away from themselves to do something else, that can plant a seed that just grows and then become resentful. And then from that becomes just moments when you say things that, you know, you can't put words back in your mouth. Once they come out, they're out, you know.
And, right.
And I think that's one of my biggest faults, is that I have said things to my children, to my wife, and to others before that if I could just take those words and cram them back into my mouth somehow, the relationship with that person, be it child or spouse, whoever, would be so much better. But once they're out, they're out. And the only thing you can do then is try to make up for it in some way. And that just sometimes leads to bitterness for the person to whom you were saying those words, and even to yourself, because you feel like, okay, I've got to do this because I couldn't keep my big mouth shut, or I let my emotions overwhelm me and said things I shouldn't have said. And we become judgmental. We get selfish. We feel like, you know, I deserve this. I work hard. You know, I should be able to do this for myself. But at the same time, we're thinking we owe that to ourselves. That means we also taking it away from somebody else. And just like those terrorists, you know, they stole mothers, fathers, children, husbands, wives, away from those people. And it's going to be very hard for anyone to show any type of love to them.
Mm-hmm.
They can.
Well, you know, I think that you provided an answer along the line, along the way, and that is that in the instance of these terrorists, they've got a heavy cross to bear. But when we do things or say things that we feel that we come to recognize have caused hurt to others, we can always seek to make amends. Whether or not they're accepted or we're granted forgiveness, at least we can do our part in reaching out and at least telling somebody that we're sorry, or by changing our behavior, as you were talking about.
Yeah, most of us, I'm sure, are like me. And that is, just can't imagine blowing yourself up just to kill some people around you, or just taking an automatic weapon and gunning down people that you don't even know. You wonder what in the world could have possibly twisted their mind to that point. They can say it's on the basis of religion, but it's really not. We've had some terrible things happen using the basis of religion. The battle for many years in Ireland. I think somewhere along the line, somebody finally came to their senses and realized, you know, this is not the right way, or the peace there would never have come. But so maybe it's going to happen in one of these days from those people from the Middle East.
Well, hopefully religion ultimately serves our souls and enhances our sense of spirituality. And how can anything that is causing harm to another person be spiritual? That's what I say. That's what I ask.
I agree with you on that. How can you take something and twist it to the point that you even say to yourself, even believe yourself, that this is something spiritual? In the long run, I think sooner or later there comes the realization, right before that big boom, that maybe it's not. I hope they have that doubt right before they go.
Well, it's a real conundrum, that's for sure. I think that the people that get into extremism have been essentially brainwashed and have become psychopaths in a sense. It seems like there's got to be a total disconnect with their sense of humanity and regard for their fellow human beings.
Well, the puzzling thing is, for many, many years, we thought it was just they took kids that were so deprived, you know, and it's easy to manipulate their minds. But now we see more and more of these terrorists are college kids. They come from well-to-do families. And you wonder why. What's the possibility to make them, you know, change that? They've totally lost. They're cut off completely from the light of any kind of spirit.
Mm-hmm.
And you wonder why they do that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I wish I had the answer, but I don't.
Well, you know, I love the fact that you quoted Gandhi. I'd love to hear what he has to say about the situation. I mean, he practiced nonviolence and the principle of non-resistance, and I don't believe that he would advocate any form of retaliation. But we live in a world where we feel like we need to be able to control things and to make things that are wrong right, and sometimes we go to extremes ourselves when we do that and retaliate in kind.
You know, right now I think it's going to take a mixture. It's going to take people who are willing to sit down with these people and try to make them understand that what they're doing is wrong, but at the same time it also people who are willing to step up and use force to protect those who are totally innocent and just on the sidelines and being killed for no reason whatsoever. These people are doing the killing don't even have an idea of what some of those people have gone through their minds. You know, they may be in favor of what they're doing, but they don't ask. They just shoot them. And it just blows my mind.
Yeah, same here. Same here. It's hard to discern what is the solution to the situation. But, you know, I've heard it said by a very wise man who's my father that there's always a solution to every problem, and usually more than one. And, you know, hindsight is 20/20, and sometimes we have to learn lessons the hard way. We do have a caller on the line. She's a regular follower of the show. She happens to be a former nurse, and she identifies herself as a light worker. Would you like to take the call?
Yes, I would.
Okay. I'm going to bring Diana on the line. Hi, Diana. How are you?
Hi, David. I'm fine. How are you?
Excellent. Do you have anything you'd like to contribute to the discussion or any questions or comments for John?
Well, I just think that it's pretty wonderful, you know, that a medical doctor is speaking in terms of light and love and forgiveness and all those things. So that gives us a lot of hope. And I don't know, you know, what the answer to the situation is. The other part, the war, and those young kids blowing themselves up. I don't know what that answer is. I would just, as a light worker, what I would do is just print the map and have love constantly flowing, maybe in some way as maybe the arc or something, a really strong, you know, how if you've got a blasting arc and you know what the arc is, on an area, then you just let God do the, you know, you did your work as a light worker. You covered the area with light and love, and that energy will be used. Kind of like the Native Americans say, let the Creator work the energy of it. Once you put the light and love into it, the Creator works that energy for you. That's the best I can do with this, because I don't have an answer.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm enjoying listening to the show. So you can put me back on hold if you want.
Well, I'd love to have your participation. We don't have a lot of time left.
Oh, okay.
But no, I'd love to have your participation. John, is there anything you'd like to say to Diana?
Well, just something you brought up about the right and the wrong. Who thinks they're right? Who thinks they're wrong? Another quote by Gandhi. He said, "What difference does it make to the dead, the orphans, and the homeless whether the mad destruction is wrought under the name of totalitarianism or the holy name of liberty or democracy?" In other words, to those kids who lost their parents, to those husbands who lost their wives, and vice versa, it doesn't matter who's right and who's wrong in this crazy battle that's going on over there. The only thing they know, their lives have been destroyed. And somebody has got to come to their senses about what's taking place, and there's got to be a magic person out there somewhere. They don't all believe in Jesus Christ, otherwise he would be. But whatever their beliefs are, they got to realize that what they're doing is wrong.
Mm-hmm. And the cat agrees with you.
I heard the cat.
At least I got one on my side.
How are we going to do it then? Can you give us the answer? You're definitely right about that. I mean, they've got to realize what they're doing wrong. And I don't know anything other than, like I said, pour light and love into the area and hope that there is a grand creator that's going to be fixing this and help those kids. But I wouldn't, you know, I would even go to the extremes to say kidnap them all of them who are willing to blow themselves up, kidnap them and put them in special houses of love and reform their intelligence and their spirit to know that they're worth more than blowing themselves up and everybody else. They're worth more than terror. I don't know how they have to learn that kind of thing anyway. I that's just beyond my comprehension, and I don't want to go there because then I would rather put the light and love into the area and stay in a higher vibration myself.
The thing I hate the most is the fact that I'm getting on long of tooth and my number of years on this earth are going to be limited, but I hate to leave this world in such a mess for my grandchildren. You know,
oh, yeah. I know.
To live even worse. And I wish there was something to do.
I think the grandchildren are going to be teachers for us all. Of course, it sounds like you came from a good, loving family. So you have a good foundation there. Others really don't even have that. Didn't come from a good foundation, still have to figure out how to live at a better place for their grandchildren. So just keep doing the good work you do. Wow. Are you still practicing medicine too?
Yes, ma'am, I am. This is my 48th year. And
you sound too young for this to be your 48th year.
Well,
wow.
I told my wife I'll never attempt retirement again. That was the most miserable 3 weeks of my life, and they'll have to take me out feet first before I quit again. So I love it too much.
That's good, because like I said, they need people that have your spirit of love out there taking care of people.
Well, let me ask you, John, you know, it seems like we're kind of at a place where we're not going to solve the problems of the world today, and that it's important to have faith that the Creator will take care of the situation as has been done during troubling times in the past. But what are your plans, future writing plans? Do you have any other books in the works?
Yes, I have one manuscript that's already in the hands of my agent. And she's promised me that she'll get to it fairly soon. She's very busy. She's very successful and quite a joy to work with. And once she gets it and goes through it, she'll tell me what I need to do with it. And I have another one that's almost completed that I'm doing about the fifth revision on. I have a tendency to, I'm unable to let go of a book sometimes. I just revise it to death, you know, and sometimes you have to let go of your baby and just send it out. But I have so much fun doing it that when I go back to it, do a revision, I say, wait, why did I do that? I should have put it this way. And then when I change that, I have to go back earlier and change something else. But in the long run, it makes it a better book. And I would just like to say for anybody out there that even has an inkling that'd like to write, do it. There is no greater way to fulfill what you call empty time. And you'll learn that when you write, you wake up a part in your brain that you'll create things you never realized were there.
What would be your suggestion for how somebody could go about that? We only have a couple of minutes remaining, but what would be the best way for them to start out?
Find a local conference. It doesn't have to be a week-long thing. It could be one day. Just go and be with writers and watch them. And writers have an expression of writers helping writers. I've never seen such unselfish people in my life. I started several years ago, went to one called Southeastern Writers Association at St. Simon's Island. People accepted me right away and started teaching me. You still there?
I am here. I was just taking it in. I totally agree with you. As somebody that also writes, I have found that other writers are very giving people, and that without their feedback, in a sense, I was lost and wandering alone. And they've told me how to make my stories more powerful. They've lovingly and constructively offered critiques that have helped me improve my own writing, and we don't have to be in it alone.
Well, that's absolutely true, and I'd be remiss if I didn't mention one writer, David L. Robbins. He's a fantastic writer. He's written about 15 novels. He's a screenplay writer. He writes plays, and he helped me tremendously. He was teaching at our conference, but I had a lot of questions for him, and although as successful as he was, he took plenty of time to help me.
Well, I'm glad you were able to get that in. Well, John, I'd like to thank you tonight for being on the show, and Diana, thank you for your contribution as well.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Diana.
All right. Well, John, best wishes to you in your medical practice and your future writing, and keep me posted on future endeavors.
I sure will, and thank you for having me on your show.
It's been my pleasure. So once again, come to a close. Now we can pause and reflect upon the idea that we are all united through the diverse tapestry of our individual gifts. There is no real thing as separation except in our own minds. We are each unique expressions, the ultimate source of our beings. We are spiritual beings having a human experience who can and will have a spiritual experience if we allow it to be. Have a great week, and remember, whatever you dream, you can realize.